Now, it's rare enough for world governments to agree on anything, but when the shared issues ensure the survival of our threatened species or the protection of our environment, well, then definitely the stakes are very high. And 2 years ago, environment ministers from almost 200 nations met in Japan, and they basically committed to a set of 20 targets aimed to stem the continuing loss of life on Earth and the destruction of biodiversity. And it was hoped that by 2020, we would have halted things like overfishing, we would have controlled invasive species, reduced pollution and taken pressure off the coral reefs, to name but a few of those goals. And so far, so good. But 2 years later, these governments have not managed to talk money. It seems many of the richer countries came with empty pockets, so no clear guidelines on financing were agreed. And that's where BirdLife International comes in. Not willing to let anyone off the hook, they have published a study presenting the hard facts on what needs to be spent if genuine progress is to be made. I'm joined by BirdLife International's Global Research Coordinator, Stuart Butchart. Stuart, good afternoon. Welcome to the programme.
Thank you.
Can you take us back to 2010? What was the tipping point that led to the 20 HE targets, as they're called, being set?
Well, back in 1990, governments recognised that we were causing widespread destruction to our environment, and this was causing all sorts of problems. So they set themselves a target to try and do something about it by 2010. And in fact, we pulled together a group of about 50 scientists from around the world, bringing together all the relevant information and indicators to show that they failed to meet the target that they set back in 1990. So against that backdrop, I mean, that result was widely accepted by the governments. They then decided they needed to develop and adopt a new strategic plan with these 20 targets that you mentioned.
Now, I did mention also that some people had come with empty pockets, but I mean, what financial commitments, if any, were given at that stage?
Well, at that stage, they agreed that they would come up with a plan for financing the strategy. So there weren't any commitments at that point, but they realised that they needed to develop an agreement. And 2 years on, not very much progress has been made. So all those governments are meeting again now in India as we speak. And the how to finance this plan is the main topic of discussion. And the lack of progress so far has partly been because of lack of information about how much it would cost to meet these different targets.
But there's 20 targets on the list. I mean, surely prioritising them would be, I mean, 20 targets are an awful lot when nothing has been done. Surely the way to do something is to do something rather than look helplessly at the whole lot.
That's right. And so we focused on two of the targets that are arguably the most urgent and certainly the most germane to the business of conservation: preventing extinctions, improving the status of threatened species, and expanding the global network of protected areas to cover key sites for biodiversity conservation.
So even so, I mean, there are lots of threatened species on the list. Are some of these to be protected, or all of them, or where are you going with the list of endangered species?
Well, the government's committed to preventing the extinction of all known threatened species. There's about 16,000 of those listed on what's widely regarded as the most authoritative list, the red list of the International Union for the Conservation of Nature. So we tried to estimate what would be the cost of improving the status of all 16,000 of those species by at least one category, so listing them at a lower category of extinction risk.
So you're actually inferring that it can be done, that money will fix it, whereas in fact some of these things are caused by climate change, by the huge increasing population on the earth. Maybe money can't fix it, all of
it. Well, there are certainly broader challenges and longer-term challenges like those that you refer to. But we think actually with the political will and appropriate resources, you could have a huge impact on the status of these species and certainly successfully improve their situation for the vast majority. And there's lots of good examples of that happening in the past to give us confidence that we could achieve these targets.
What kind of examples?
Well, a few years ago, we carried out a study to try and ask how many species of birds would have gone extinct over the previous 10 years were it not for our conservation efforts. And there are 16 species like the black stilt in New Zealand, or the pale-naped brush finch, a small bird of forest in Ecuador. these things would have disappeared from the planet were it not for the efforts that conservation organisations have put in to keep them around. And using those examples, we can look at the sorts of actions that would be required for all other threatened species and start to get a handle on what those might cost.
The research you've done, am I right in thinking it shows that only just over kind of 10% of the money needing to be spent has been spent, for example, on birds?
That's right. We know that birds are probably better funded than other groups because they're popular and charismatic, and there's more resources available for them than there might be for some threatened fish or a small plant. And so overall, we think that we probably need at least an order of magnitude increase in the investments required for nature conservation.
Stuart, you're looking at conflicts of interest fundamentally here. If you take something like the Brazilian rainforest, which some people have their eye on to cut down and turn into farmland so they can raise beef cattle, or the Pantanal. And now you're looking there at people recognise that you will destroy biodiversity if you remove the Pantanal or parts of the rainforest. But the issue isn't one of costs. Or if it is one of costs, you have to balance the costs, the loss to the farming communities or whatever, to Brazil or Bolivia, as the case may be. You have to balance that cost against what you would gain by preserving them. Are you taking those kind of second-order costs into account when you come up with your figures?
Well, for this study, we were just focusing on how much would the actions cost in order to achieve these targets that the governments have set. But and the numbers, which we can talk about in a moment, are pretty large. But it's important to place them into context. And actually, they are tiny by comparison to the benefits we get back from nature. And what you're saying is absolutely right, but what hasn't happened sufficiently to date is that the true value of nature is factored into those sorts of decisions and decisions about how to use our land. So those areas like the Amazon or like the wetlands in the Pantanal are providing enormous benefits both to local communities, to more distant populations, or to people all around the world in terms of the ecosystem services, they're called. So things like pollination of our crops, provision of clean water, or in the case of the Amazon, regulation of our climate. And because we don't adequately incorporate the those sorts of benefits from biodiversity into economic systems, it leads to decisions like chopping all the forest down to allow cattle to graze on the land.
Stuart, it seems to me that in principle everybody is in agreement, but that we're just not talking hard numbers here. What sort of money are you talking about, and how on earth are you going to get the goodwill for people to actually do it?
Well, so using our data for birds and then extrapolating that to give us totals for all types of wildlife, we estimated that the costs of preventing extinctions and improving the status of threatened species of animals and plants comes out at about $3 to $5 billion every year. And the amount needed to adequately protect and manage all important sites for biodiversity across the world is about $76 billion a year. Now, those seems like enormous sums to us as individuals, but in terms of government budgets, they're trivial. So, for example, that cost for improving the status of species is less than the amount that the UK's Royal Navy new aircraft carrier is over budget, or the amount for both the species and the sites targets is less than half the amount spent on bankers' bonuses last year.
Well, when you mention the bankers, obviously, but I'm just thinking, if you said to somebody, OK, let's not refurbish or rebuild or overspend on an aircraft carrier and let's protect a species, I don't think people will get the relevance between the two. I don't think they'll be able to make that decision. You know, I think it's going to be a tough call.
Sure, it's tough, and if it was easy, we wouldn't be here now having this discussion, and we would have implemented all the actions and raised all the funding for it. But the important point is to explain that these are not simply bills. They are investments in natural capital. Spend this money now wisely, and you'll get returns back that are orders of magnitude larger.
You don't miss the water till the well runs dry. So telling people that if we don't conserve the mangrove forest, we'll have even more storms, or if we don't conserve the rainforest, our climate will change, they frankly don't believe this. It's only when it's done and it's happened that they'll say, oh yeah, we should have done it. So how do you get over this deficit of belief? I mean, even things like climate change doesn't, I mean, we know what causes it, CO2 up in the atmosphere, but knowing what causes it and spending money on fixing it are two completely different things.
Sure, and that's why examples that really bring home this message are important. So if you look at the appalling Asian tsunami from a few years ago, those coastal communities in Southeast Asia that still had intact mangrove forests along their shorelines suffered far less in terms of loss of human life and economic destruction than the communities and the places where those mangrove forests have been chopped down. And that sort of example really brings home the message of the benefits that ecosystems can provide to us, and that it makes economic sense to conserve them.
How much, can you remember, did you spend on the black stilt and actually saving that from extinction?
I don't have those numbers to hand, but when we estimated the costs required for a whole sample of threatened species, mm-hmm. you see enormous variation. So some species are pretty expensive because they're in developed countries with very large ranges. Some are much, much cheaper. So looking at those two ends of the spectrum, the California condor, it's amazing. It's the world's largest vulture. Used to be found over quite a large area of North America, became extinct in the wild. There were just a handful of individuals left. And now there's a major program that's working on breeding them in captivity, releasing them back into the wild, providing supplementary feeding, and trying to tackle the issue of lead shot, which they ingest when they feed on carcasses of animals that have been hunted, which then poisons them. So trying to tackle all of that across quite a large area. The budget for that ought to be probably more than $10 million a year. At the other end of the scale, the blue-crowned laughing thrush, a beautiful bird found in parts of China, it's got a very, very small range. It probably only needs a few tens of thousands of dollars a year to help raise awareness amongst the local communities in the places where it's found, and to protect it from the development of infrastructure and housing and buildings and so on.
Well, Stuart, it's going to be a long, hard road ahead of you, but we need campaigners like yourself and indeed BirdLife International. Thank you so much for joining us this afternoon on The Mooney Show.
It was a pleasure.